I want to welcome everyone back to People of the Book. Believe it or not, this is the 14th class, which means next week is the 15th and the final week.
Are we having another series?
Next year. By Goldberg and I are already planning. We will most certainly... Oh, ye of little faith. You don't give us enough credit. The problem is there aren't so many of them, but... We're already in the midst of planning for next year.
Just trying to see.
No, we're good, thank you.
And
we're already in the midst of planning for next year, and we're toying with a few tweaks to the model. So stay in touch, stay tuned, and God willing, we will only get bigger and better. Last week you studied the Baal Shem Tov. And I have no idea what Rabbi Kasorla taught, but I'm assuming he gave somewhat of a background introduction to Hasidism. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay. Today, we are going to present what I'll call the counter perspective to what Rabbi Kasorla taught last week. And what I want to do is start off with a story. The story took place in the beginning around 1822, the beginning of the 19th century, at a famous wedding of the Apterov. Or not the Apterov, but the Apterov was there. Wedding was taking place, the Apterov was there. And at the wedding, a certain chassid of the Apterov, who was otherwise, I believe, known as the Oev Yisrael, so came and started attacking the school of thought that we are going to discuss tonight, and that is Rav Simcha Bunim of Pshischa, the Pshischa model of Hasidic thought. And I want to read you two excerpts of recordings that we have from that episode, just to paint the picture. You don't have this in front of you, and I don't want you to read it. I want you to listen to it and envision the image that is taking place. So we're at this beautiful wedding. A Hasidic wedding doesn't have one or two people, it has one or 2,000 people. And so there's a massive wedding taking place. A certain Hasid, who was a Hasid of the Apterov, gave testimony. So they're starting basically a court case. And he says his Rebbe had given him a talisman, which is a skula, okay, a silken belt, white as snow, that he should wear continuously. So this guy's Rebbe had given him a silken belt that the Rebbe said as a skula, as a basically, you know, like when you talk about the red bendels, the red strings around your wrist. So this guy's Rebbe had given him a white silk belt. And near his house, there dwelt a neighbor who was a student of Pshischa, who used to come to the house and greatly mock the talisman. So he used to make fun of this guy's belt that his Rebbe had given him. And once when nobody was around, the neighbor came and took the belt and smeared it all over with black paint, and afterwards was full of mirth. And many other opponents brought similar examples as to how the glory of the tzaddikim of the generation was demeaned in the eyes of the Hasidim of Pshischa, and that their teacher had definitely taught them thus, for only his way was the way of truth. So you're sitting at this wedding, Rav Shimcha Bunim of Pshischa is there, the Apterov is there, and all of these students of Hasidim come and bring stories about how the students of Pshischa, or Rav Simcha Bunim himself, was essentially defaming, was essentially causing ill will, was essentially ruining the name of other Hasidim by their actions. And they brought this court, so to speak, to this court case, to the Apterov. And I'll read you one other excerpt. This is from a different work. When the opponents of Rabbunim, the person that we are going to speak about tonight, saw the honor given to our teacher and his companions by the Apterov, so the Apterov, even though all of the opponents of Pshischa thought, the Apterov was still giving great honor, was still giving great kavod to Rav Simcha Bunim. The Apterov was a famous Hasidic Rebbe. He was otherwise known as the Oev Yisrael. We don't need to know too much about him now. But he was the Rav at the time. Okay? So they were very angry, and they decided to arraign their case in public. So they want to air their grievances against Pshischa in public, to excommunicate Rabbanim and all those that followed him. So there was a mass attempt at this wedding, where they were aligning different schools of thought, Pshischa on one end, all other forms of Hasidim on the other end, and they want to try to excommunicate Rav Simcha Banim of Pshischa, the person we are going to read about tonight. The case was as follows. This was the case as it was recorded. That the Hasidim of Rav Bunim have departed the way of Hasidism. They speak falsely and ridicule all of the tzaddikim and their students. They are lenient concerning a number of forbidden things. They delay the time of prayer until after midday. They have almost ceased to learn the revealed Torah, in other words, Gemara. Every day is a festival for them. They eat, drink, sing, and dance, and because of his Hasidism has become a joke and a derision amongst the ordinary people, so that God is disgraced. There were some who slandered the Hasidim of Pshischa, saying that they were not careful to keep explicit laws in the Shulchan Aruch. They were lenient publicly and not fasting on our 4 fast days, and they did not wait the fixed time between milk and meat. So there were all these claims levied against the students of Pshischa, Rav Simcha Bunim himself, and the Abderav ultimately deemed Pshischa a valid form of Hasidic thought, okay, bringing them, so to speak, back into the fold. And what I want to speak about tonight is, what is it about the Pshischa form of thought? What was it about the Pshischa Hasidim that created such a strong and harsh reaction from other Hasidim, almost to the extent that they wanted to excommunicate Rav Simcha Bunim? They wanted to excommunicate one of their own because they felt that Pshischa thought was so detrimental, was so dangerous to how Hasidism was viewed on the outside, that they basically wanted to push Rav Simcha Bunim and his followers to the outside. And our goal tonight, and hopefully by the end, we will understand why there was such a harsh reaction. How did the Pshischa form of Hasidism differ so greatly from what perhaps Rabbi Kasorla articulated for you last week? And in the process, hopefully we'll hone in a little bit on a more deeper understanding of how Hasidism thought works and how it perhaps doesn't work. Okay, so that's our goal for tonight. Yeah. We're going to get there. Okay? We're going to get there. I actually don't have a good answer for you for that. Someone has a computer here. They can Google that. I actually don't know. I'm going to guess somewhere in Ukraine. That's a guess. Ukraine or Poland? If anyone has their iPhone here, they can... Ukraine or Poland, Russia, somewhere around there. I actually don't have a good answer for you.
Eastern Europe.
Okay. So before we get into Pshischa, which, if you Google, has like 15 different ways of writing it, depending on how academic, not academic you are. I went with the... Well, I didn't write it here, but I went with the... how it sounds, the phonetic way of saying it, okay? But before we get into that, I want to do a basic overview of classic Hasidic thought, okay? And many of this, hopefully, will be familiar to you. If it is, nod your head. If it isn't, shake your head side to side. That way I understand how much I have to go into depth, and how much we can just kind of gloss over this peripheral. Okay? So let's start here. Central to Hasidic thought is the notion of the tzaddik. Tzaddikism, as they say, whatever, right? The notion of the tzaddik. In classic Hasidic thought, the tzaddik is the main focus, almost serving as an intermediary between what I'll call it, the lowly individual, the regular Joe Schmo on the street, and God. That there needs to be some form of an intermediary to intercede on behalf of the average man. That becomes the tzaddik. So in classic Hasidic thought, the tzaddik plays a major role. Not just in a way we understand it, in almost like a practical role, that the average person simply is an unworthy, but even in a very metaphysical way. The idea that the tzaddik has a metaphysical significance, i.e. that all Jewish souls are interwoven and dependent on him in some metaphysical fashion. Somehow the tzaddik by his righteousness elevates the souls of the individuals. Okay, so again, it's not just a practical, I as an individual living in the Ukraine, Poland, don't know how to pray adequately. So I need the tzaddik to come and to pray on my behalf. We're not talking, I mean, it's that too. But it's also on some metaphysical level. Okay? And that the role of the tzaddik is to redeem the masses. You're going to learn a lot more about this next week, I can almost guarantee you. When Rabbi Goldberg talks about Rav Nachman of Breslov, okay? And one of the things Rabbi Goldberg, and the reason why I'm pretty sure he's going to talk about this is because I sent him about 5 articles about it, so I'm guessing he's going to talk about it. But anyone know anyone who's ever gone to Uman for Rosh Hashanah? Okay? So why do you go to Uman for Rosh Hashanah? I don't want to steal Rabbi Goldberg's thunder, but I want to try to help develop this idea. Why do people go to Uman for Rosh Hashanah? That's where he's buried. Who cares that's why he's buried, right? What does it mean? So Rav Nachman said in his writings that anyone who comes to his grave on Rosh Hashanah, he'll guarantee them redemption. But what about Uman? What was it about Uman? What's so special? But go to Yerushalayim. Go to... What happened in Uman?
There were 30,000 people buried
there. So I don't know the exact number, but there was a mass murder that took place in Uman. Rav Nachman was of the impression that the souls of these 30,000 people who never received a proper... They were kind of hovering. They hadn't been properly redeemed. And so Rav Nachman felt by his being buried in Uman, he was causing a redemption to these unredeemed souls. Okay, and that's why specifically Uman carries significance in Breslov thought. I'm not going more into it. I guarantee you Rabbi Goldberg will talk about it next week. Okay, but it's that notion that the tzaddik on some level is able to redeem the masses. Parenthetically, before we go on, I'll anticipate your question. A lot of what we're going to talk about in terms of the role of the tzaddik will sound very much like Christianity. Okay, the role of a certain figure in Christianity whose purpose is to redeem, to create wholeness, to bring down God's goodwill into this world. Okay, so yes, the answer is yes, but that plays a major role into classic Hasidic thought. Okay, and by extension, the tzaddik redeems the physical world by redeeming the sparks of holiness from the husks of corporeality, in other words, materialism. Okay, again, the tzaddik's role is to redeem. So he's redeeming the physical world, he's redeeming the sparks of holiness. What does that mean, the sparks of holiness? So I'll get to it in the next couple slides. I want to share with you one comment. This is from the Divrei Emet. It could have been any number of Sfarim, but it represents this classical Hasidic view, where it says, hold fast to a Rebbe who is called a father, and he will help you in every matter which you have need, for he is attached to him, namely God, through the truth, which is God, and he will bless you. God will bless you. Okay, so it's again, it's the tzaddik who is attached to God, and it's through the tzaddik that God is going to shower his blessing onto this world. Now again, we talked about it not just being on a practical level, but even being on a metaphysical level. What does that mean, a metaphysical level? So central to Hasidic thought is the following notion, which I preempt by saying I don't understand. Okay? I'm not yet 40, I don't study Kabbalah, and I don't get it. I can intellectualize it, but in my kishkas I can't tell you what it means. So you'll learn it with me. But and again, you can read this in any number of different works, but somehow there's this concept that there was a rupture between God and his Shechina. Okay, those in Hasidic thought and Kabbalah are two different thoughts. I'm sure if Shoshana Dichter was here, she could describe it more eloquently than I can. But somehow there was this rupture. It is the role of the tzaddik to repair that rupture, to create unity. This is done by interceding and beseeching God to bring goodness down to the Jewish people. Again, so even if we don't understand the details of it, what's clear is that somehow the tzaddik is creating wholeness in the world. They're bringing the world back to where it is supposed to be. So again, it's not just on a practical level that I, who don't have a good education, can't pray properly, and therefore I need a tzaddik to pray on my behalf. But there's a metaphysical element to it, which says that the tzaddik, because of his holy level, is actually able to repair things in the world. Right beyond what we could see physically, the tzaddik is able to repair the world in a way that we can't even understand, and therefore the tzaddik plays such a fundamental role. Yeah?
How is he chosen to be a tzaddik?
Ah, so good. So how is he chosen to be a tzaddik? So we'll see that that's going to be one of the differences between Pshischa and other Hasidism. Most other Hasidic movements, it's passed down. There's a clear transition of power. Okay, where the Rebbe appoints basically the next Rebbe. We'll see that in Pshischa that does not happen, and we'll see why. That's actually a great question. It's going to be central to us understanding Pshischa. Because why there is that difference is a major why. It's a capital W. A good question. Okay? So the tzaddik is on a higher level. Now understand that when we talk about the tzaddik and the everyday man, and I'm sure Rabbi Kasorla spoke about this last week, that is what made Hasidic thought so popular. Okay, if you were in a more Lithuanian model of learning at that time, Lithuanian model says that if you're not an Eloi, if you're not a great, knowledgeable Talmudic scholar by the age of 11, 12, or 13, so you were out of the yeshiva and you had to work at your parents' blacksmith factory or whatever the case might be. Right? The average person, according to a Lithuanian model, where Gemara learning was the peak, it was the pinnacle of academic excellence in Judaism, and if you couldn't hack it, which was most people, by the way, so you failed to receive an education past 8th grade. Okay, the average person, if you were in a Lithuanian model, was told that you basically, again, I'm paraphrasing, but trying to create an image, you failed the system if you didn't go to one of the great yeshivas. Even when we talk about the great yeshivas of the 19th century, they were very small. Okay, even at their height, these yeshivot were very, very small. So, for example, you talk about a yeshiva called Kelm, which some people may have heard. A couple dozen students there at a time. Even Volozhin, which was the major, major yeshiva, maybe 100, 200 students at a time. We're not talking about monstrous yeshivot. The average person, again, A, they were educated in their local communities, but the average person, unless you became the next Rosh Yeshiva, the next major Talmudic scholar, you were out on the street. So when Hasidic thought came along and said, you can be an average Joe Schmo, you could be a blacksmith, you could be a wagon driver, you could be a car salesman, whatever the example might be, and still be a great Jew, so that's a very appealing concept. Now, how can you be a great Jew? You might not know a lot. You may not have an education past 8th grade. So how do you become a great Jew according to Hasidic thought? It's not simple in their mind, but it's very simple in our mind, which is that you connect yourself to the tzaddik. It's through the tzaddik that you achieve a level of holiness. The tzaddik is up there. By me attaching myself to him, I, so to speak, vicariously attach myself to God. Okay? So I don't need to be the Talmudic scholar necessarily. I can be the blacksmith. But if I attach myself to the Rebbe, I go to him for Yom Tovim and Shabbos and for bringing, whatever they called them back then. And through the singing and the ecstatic experience of Judaism, I connect myself to him. So I have now connected myself to God, even though I'm a lowly individual. So it became there was a tremendous mass appeal to it, because it meant you could be anyone and still achieve that level of holiness. Yeah. Who said that there shouldn't be an intermediary? Who said so? The tzaddik is that role. According to classic Hasidic thought, the tzaddik is that role. Right? So I might not be on such a level that I can connect to God, but I can connect myself to the tzaddik. Now, a Hasidic Rebbe sitting here would say, you think it's easy to connect yourself to the Rebbe? No, and there are writings that document this. They don't believe that connecting yourself to the Rebbe is easy. And that's the next slide. The next slide is, if the Rebbe plays such a major role in Hasidic thought, then what's the obligation of the Chassid? What does the Chassid do? Okay? Funny that you should ask. What is the obligation of the Chassid? So the obligation of the Chassid, first and foremost, is total and utter allegiance. It's a complete, undeniable devotion to the Rebbe. It's submitting your own self to the Rebbe. It's losing yourself. You'll sometimes hear that. You lose yourself in the presence of the Rebbe. A certain humility, a certain lowliness, right? I lose myself in the presence of the Rebbe. The greater the belief of the Chassid and the Tzaddik, the more the Tzaddik was empowered to affect God. Okay? So to speak, when I lose myself in the Tzaddik becomes bolstered in his ability, again, whatever this means, his ability to bring down God's blessing becomes enhanced. Redemption, according to classic Hasidic thought, is vicarious. One is basically riding the coattails of the Rebbe. Okay, so I don't need to become the great Talmudic scholar. The Rebbe, the Tzaddik, is that righteous person. The Tzaddik represents holiness. I, simply by connecting myself to the Tzaddik, am able to, basically through osmosis, I am able to achieve whatever levels of holiness are to be achieved, right? That's why you have this a lot in Hasidic thought. Think about the nature of Shirayim, right? You go to the Rebbe's tish and you want a little bit of the Rebbe's food that he blessed. So why is that? Again, because I want to do whatever I can to connect myself to the Rebbe. Whatever the Rebbe touches and eats and blesses, I want to have a piece of that. That is the most sacred thing that a chassid could have, is something directly from the Rebbe, because the Rebbe isn't just a person. The Rebbe represents the direct conduit to God Himself. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he can't, but there's clearly this concept of the Rebbe's abilities are enhanced by the devotion of his students. Okay? Here's just one quote, just to show you again this concept in real life. For there are those who do not have the strength of self-sacrifice in practice other than by connecting to tzaddikim. In other words, I'm a lowly black. I hope no one here is a blacksmith, and I'm picking on the blacksmith. But I feel like when you think about 19th century, like, ghetto life, you think of a blacksmith, okay? So, if you're the blacksmith, okay? So I don't have the self-sacrifice. I might not have the willpower to be a tzaddik myself, but I can connect to a tzaddik. And that is what is meant by, quote, every Jew has a portion in the world to come. Ko Yisrael yeshlam chelek le'olam haba. How can every Jew have a portion in the world to come? This is to say that they have a portion in the world to come by connecting with tzaddikim, but not by themselves alone. Okay? So I can't achieve it. You're all giving me weird looks. The reason why you're giving me weird looks, recognize, is because you view the world through a Maimonidean perspective. Okay? You view the world by a Maimonides as 13 principles of faith, one of which says there shouldn't be any intermediary between you and God. Okay? No one would ever confuse Maimonidean thought with Hasidic thought. Okay, so we have to undo a little bit of what our rational, you know, Aristotelian, Maimonidean minds tell us, and envelop yourself in a Hasidic mindset, which says that there is this concept that you need the tzaddik to allow you or to help you, to assist you in connecting to the world to come. Yeah.
It seems there was something missing.
They weren't seeking to transport themselves. They were seeking a connection to holiness. They were seeking a connection to holiness. And what made Hasidic thought so popular was that exact notion. Was that you could be an everyday man with very little knowledge in your own faults and flaws, but by connecting yourself to someone righteous, you had the capacity to merit the world to come. That is a very popular and populist notion, which is why, again, let's take a step back, okay? Why were the Misnagdim, the Vilna Gaon and others, did Rabbi Goldberg end up doing the Vilna Gaon? Or that was the skipped one? Okay. So next year, when you learn the Vilna Gaon, you'll come back to this. But one of the reasons that made them so furious in their opposition to Hasidic thought was this exact reason. In other words, yes, it has mass appeal, but there was also this impression of it dumbing down Judaism. Dumbing down by the mean, shifting the emphasis from Torah learning to other ways of connecting to God, which they don't view as valid necessarily. According to a Misnagid, Torah is the way to connect to God. If we learn about Nefesh HaChaim, the Rav Chaim Volozhin, who founded the Volozhin Yeshiva, so his whole thesis in his Nefesh HaChaim is that Torah is the way you connect to God. There's no greater way to connect to God. God gave us his Torah and says, here's my blueprint, go and study it. So a Misnagid is going to look at that and say, why would you supplement that with anything else? And Hasidic thought will come along and say, I'll tell you why, because the average person can't do it. Yeah.
But they had no choice. They couldn't learn. They didn't have the time. That's
what my quote says, right? They do not have the strength for self-sacrifice. In other words, there were people who simply couldn't do it. So the way you did it was by connecting yourself to the tzaddik. Yeah, and then we may have to go on. Yeah. Yeah, you and I would be a chassid. Rabbi Goldberg would be a tzaddik, right? In other words, the tzaddik is the right. The tzaddik is he's the rebbe. He's the rebbe. He's the one sitting at the front of the tish table. Okay. Yeah. Well, last one. Absolutely. That was the whole emphasis of it. Ah, so we're going to get to that. It's a great question. Helen asked, does that mean you didn't have to feel motivated? In other words, this seems to take the average chassid off the hook a little bit. And we'll see, that's one of the major... I couldn't have thought of a better... I actually would have planted that question had I thought of it in advance. Okay?
I did.
Right, no. But that's actually one of the things that Pshischa rebels against, and it really was a rebellion, was Pshischa wanted to reinfuse Judaism with a sense of autonomy. In other words, they felt that classic Hasidic thought was robbing people of their own autonomy. Right? If all you were doing was giving over your ego to the tzaddik and you had no responsibility yourself, they said, that what kind of Judaism? Is that what God wants from you? That's what they would say. And we'll see that in practice as we go along. Okay. That actually took a lot longer than I thought. The average... Let's go... No, it's great. It's great. Okay? Not your average Rebbe. Rav Simcha Bunim. What do we know about him? So we know the following. He was born in Władysław, Poland in 1766. Where's Władysław, Poland?
In Poland.
I have no idea. I'll tell you why I have no idea. Because I Googled it, and Władysław doesn't exist anymore. The only thing you get is stuff about the Holocaust. Which means that it must have existed at some point and got lost. But usually Google like translates this to modern day places. But I have no idea where in Poland it is, but it's in Poland. Okay? His father was Ritzvi, a well-known darshan who wrote Eretz Tzvi, in which bears an approbation from the Noda B'Yehuda, who we learned about this year. I share that with you just to show you that he grew up in a very rabbinic house. Okay? His mother at Yichus, she was a descendant of the Bach, Rav Yoel Sirkis, who we find on the side of the Tor. Okay? The side of the Tor, the Bach, is the Bach and the Beit Yosef are the two major commentaries on the side of the Tor. So again, he comes from a very rabbinic family. However, while he went to yeshiva, he then went into business. Rav Simcha Bunim was not your average Hasidic Rebbe. He spent the beginning parts of his life, not as you would and I would envision a Rebbe would, but he ventured into business. Okay, he was a bookkeeper, he was in timber business. I mean, he was really just an average of the mill Joe, Shmo. Okay? Not only that, but he was very educated. Very cultured Joe Shmo. Okay? They have records of him playing chess, of him going to theaters, all with assimilated Jews. Okay? And we'll see why that's important shortly. He was fully conversant with the culture of his time. He understood the local language. He understood the customs of people. So it'd be the equivalent of, you know, when a rabbi gets up there and shares a little bit of pop culture, he was holding in pop culture. He understood that stuff. Okay? He dressed in a Western style. Again, none of these things would you associate with a classic Hasidic Rebbe. Why does he do all of this? He does all this because it gave him insight into human nature. Okay? One of the central components of the Pshischa model is an awareness of human nature. An awareness of how people actually work. When you strip up us of all of our egos and all of our ulterior motives, what's really inside of us? How do we actually work? What actually drives us? So Simcha Bunim purposefully enveloped himself with culture around him to try to understand people themselves. Hey, he was a Rebbe for 12 years, and we have no books about him. We have no books that he directly wrote. All we have are books recounting things that he said and things that he did from his students. But he actually didn't publish anything in his lifetime.
How did he become a Rebbe?
How does anyone become a Rebbe? Oh, so we'll see.
He wasn't descended.
No, he wasn't.
He'd come right out one day.
He wasn't. We're going to get to that, okay? We're going to get to that, okay? But last, let's see again. One comment written about him. My teacher, Rabbunim, would enter into places as a trial despite their danger, something the Tanaim and the Amoraim would not do. He wasn't afraid to go to the theater. He wasn't afraid to play cards with an assimilated Jew. Okay? He was the first Rabbi Brody. Okay? He was not afraid to do Kirov, even if it took him into, quote-unquote, religiously dangerous places. Because he wanted to understand the human psyche. He wanted to understand what actually drove a person to do what they did. Okay? Now, I just told Hensha that we're going to get to that. Okay? When we talk about Pshischa, so where does Pshischa come from? So last week you learned about the Baal Shem Tov. Okay? Baal Shem Tov does not become a mass movement in the time of the Baal Shem Tov. Usually that's what happens. The Vilna Gaon, was not a mass movement until his students came along. Okay? Baal Shem Tov's major student is the Maggid of Mezrich, Rav Eli Melech of Lezhansk. Okay, then we get to the Seer of Lublin in the Yehudi. The Seer of Lublin, again, I'll give you a great book at the end if you want to know more in depth about all these different personalities. Okay? The Seer of the Lublin and the Yehudi are basically Rav Simcha Bunim's two major rebbes. There's two major Rabbanim. And when we talk about Rav Simcha Bunim, most of what we know about him comes either from him or the Yehudi, from things written about him or things written about the Yehudi. Okay? The Seer was what we'll call a classic Hasidic Rebbe, and the Yehudi and Rav Simcha Bunim take a 180 degree turn and kind of go off into this own direction of Pshischa. So they have a lineage, Hensha, to answer your question, going back to the Baal Shem Tov, but they clearly divert right about here. Okay? Famous students of Rav Simcha Bunim that you may have heard of are the Chidushei Harim, okay? The Ishbitzer Rebbe, I don't know if anyone's ever heard of the Ishbitzer, and the Kutzke Rebbe. Okay, the Kutzke Rebbe, toward the end of his life, I believe for the last 12 years, locks himself in seclusion. And when he dies, that ultimately ends the Pshischa school, and the rest of it basically becomes enveloped back into classic Hasidic thought and all becomes melded into one. Okay? Okay, let's go to the philosophy of Pshischa. I want to articulate three major areas of philosophy. There are many more, but I want to try to keep things understandable and simple. So three major areas of Pshischa, and particularly where Pshischa differed from what you and I would call a classic Hasidic approach. So number one is the Yehudi, again, which is Rav Simcha Bunim's Rebbe, which for our purposes is going to be somewhat interchangeable because their philosophy draws upon one another. So he wanted to do something revolutionary. He wanted to unite the worlds of Torah and Tefillah. Now, you and I laugh about that. But that was a real revolutionary concept. Because at least in that time period, there was the notion that in Hasidic thought, you were interested in prayer. Right? You go out into the woods, you have a little one-on-one with God, and you pray. It's a service of the heart. Whereas there was the impression that in the Lithuanian model, the Misnagan model, you were only concerned about learning Torah, you were only concerned about what was in the head, and you had lost a sense of the heart. Okay, Pshischa comes along and says you need both. Now, why was this such a major knock on classic Hasidic thought? But essentially, he told the Hasidic rabbis of that time, is you've lost your way. You've robbed Judaism of Torah learning. How can you tell the average Jew that he is not required to learn Torah, or that the emphasis is no longer on learning Torah? And so Pshischa tries to reinfuse Judaism, or reinfuse Hasidic Judaism, with a strong sense of Gemara learning, with a strong sense of classic Torah learning. And I want to share with you two quotes to that end. Number one, Rabbanim once said that he would not go to hell. That's a good thing. Okay? For anyone who had a special way of behaving and had never broken it, would not be taken to hell. In other words, if you had customs that were virtuous and you kept to those customs, that was your ticket into the good life. Okay? What was his special custom? His special custom of behavior was that he studied Gemara every day. In the celestial world, he would choose to learn Shas with the Amsterdam edition. In other words, all Rav Bunim wanted to do was sit down with his Gemara, maybe an iced tea and a cigar, whatever it was, right? But he wanted to be learning Gemara. Okay? That is certainly, in a generalized term, a divergence from what you and I would associate as a classical Hasidic approach. And just another comment, he writes, if a person has no mikvah, then he should learn Gemara instead. Okay, so instead of going to the mikvah in the morning, you envelop yourself, you delve into the sea of the Talmud. Okay, so again, one of the things they tried to do is they basically rebelled against the Hasidim of the time, saying, you have moved too far away from Gemara learning, but our form says that Gemara learning is just as important as everything else. Now, they don't go over to the side of the Misnagdim, because to them there are other sides as well. You also have to have the soul of Judaism. You have to have the heart of Judaism. Okay? And so you'll see quotes like this on the other end. When the holy Rav Chanoch Henoch of Alexander, I didn't quote him, he's not one of the famous ones, but another one of the students of Rabbanim, was 13 years old, he was taken as a bridegroom. While the engagement ceremony was being arranged, the Yehudi examined him in Talmud. He asked the Yehudi, a 13-year-old kid, he said, I'm waiting to get engaged, right there, signing the Tanaim, so can you examine me, give me a fahir. How do I do in Gemara study? So he asked him a question, again, I cut some out for space issues, but the Yehudi asked this guy a question. The kid couldn't answer it at first. After a while, he gave an answer, okay? At which point, the Yehudi said back to him, he pinched his cheek, and said to him, I saw that from Torah alone, a person cannot come to perfection. But there's a God of heaven and earth who rules over the world, and from this comes the goal of perfection. In other words, it's not just about Torah, right? On the one hand, it is about Torah learning. On the other hand, it's not just about Torah learning. There has to be some other form of relationship with God, right? Some other form of devotion, of a way to bring a person to perfection that is found outside of Gemara learning. That's what you and I would call the soul of Judaism. Okay, so it's the classic Hasidic approach coupled with this focus on Gemara learning. Okay? Another quote. Rabbanim once told that once he traveled with the Gaon Rabbi Akiva Eiger. Akiva Eiger again was one of the great Talmudic scholars of that day and age. Rabbanim asked Rabbi Akiva Eiger a question. Posen is a place of scholars, and Torah protects both when one is engaged in study and when one is not. How come then the town of Posen is not protected from assimilation? Right? If you have so many kolim there, right? How come people go off the derech, basically? Okay? And he didn't answer him a word, right? Rav Akiva Eiger didn't have an answer. I'm not doing well tonight. And our teacher said, namely, Rabbanim answered back, I'll tell you the answer. Before the pre-messianic stage, learning the revealed Torah was sufficient. In other words, before the pre-messianic stage, learning Gemara was enough. But today, in the pre-messianic stage, the revealed Torah is insufficient. One needs something hidden in the innermost parts of one's heart. Okay? In other words, it's not just enough to learn anymore, says Rav Simcha Bonham. It's not just enough to subscribe to the Misnagid approach to Judaism, but it has to be coupled with something in your heart, with something that speaks to the neshama, something that speaks to the soul. Okay? So again, you have elements of the classic Hasidic approach, but you also have this introduction that's not enough alone. We have to be reintroduced to a serious form of Talmudic study as well. Okay? That's area number one, Torah and Tefillah. Okay? Area number one where Shischa really diverged from a classic Hasidic approach. Area number two, purity of motive. Purity of motive is absolutely, positively, 100% the central component of Pshischa thought. Okay? They abhorred anything that reeked of inauthenticity. Okay? So if I'm a rabbi, or I'm a rebbe, or I'm a tzaddik, which I might be a rabbi, but I'm none of the latter two, right? And the only reason I'm doing that is to receive your compliments and adulation, so first of all, you shouldn't be a rabbi. Second of all, that to Pshischa is the worst thing a person can do. If I am only a Rebbe so that you can sit around at my tish and tell me how great I am and make me feel like $1 million, then I'm the worst and lowliest form of a Jew. Okay? Motive to Pshischa is the most important thing in Judaism. And in order to do that, what do you need? What do you need in order to understand your own motives? What do you need to be willing to do? Introspection, honesty, right? You need to be willing to look inside of yourself in a very painful way sometimes to understand why it is you do what you do and whether or not you're doing things for the right reasons. Okay? Oh. So Pshischa refused to accept anything that smelled of falseness or self-deception, whether it be the honor for the Rebbe or a particular religious practice. You can already see how this was not very popular. Because when Pshischa gets up and says, any Rebbe who's a Rebbe only because they want people to... Wait, the tzaddik in Hasidic thought is the most important thing. And when you start attacking the tzaddik, what are you doing? You're attacking their form of religion itself. Okay? That's part of what made it so problematic. If you look at your source sheets, source number one, just to give you an example of the extent to which they refused to accept anything that smelled of falseness. Now, these are all English sources. They're actually all Hebrew sources. They were all translated into English in a book that I'll cite at the end. But they're all from that book. And again, if you want to know everything you ever want to know about Rav Simcha Bunim, then I recommend reading that book. And if not, then I basically summarizing that book for you in an hour and a half. Okay? When Rav Shmaya the elder lay on his deathbed, his fellow Kutz disciples asked him. Again, Kutz is a direct descendant, so to speak, of Pshischa. They asked him, Shmaya, what about the Yetzer Hara? Does it still trouble a man even now? They were curious, right? An evil inclination that follows you your entire life. They say, what about it now? What a question, muttered Rav Shmaya with his eyes half closed. Don't you see how the Yetzer Hara is standing here at the head of the bed, whispering in my ear? Rav Shmaya, say Shema Yisrael in a loud voice and draw out the word Echad. Okay? Now why would the Yetzer Hara want Rav Shmaya to do that? What greater way for a tzaddik to die than with the words of Shema on his lips? That could be a Rebbe story for generations. What a tzaddik this guy is, right? So Shmaya continued, I recognized him, the thief. I know his intention. He is trying to seduce me to say Shema Yisrael in order that after my death you will say that Shmaya left this world in a pure state on the word of Echad. Hey, notice how he refers to the Yetzer Hara. What word? Thief. Why does he refer to the Yetzer Hara as a thief? What's the Yetzer Hara stealing here? It steals your own integrity. It steals who you are. It's forcing you to be someone that you're not. If Rav Shmaya were to die with the words Echad on his lips, you and I would think that he was a holy person, which he may or may not have been. But it would have robbed Rav Shmaya of who he truly is, of his authentic self. In Pshischa, that's the worst possible thing a person can do. Okay? So a person has to be willing to confront their Yetzer Hara, and therefore, again, it's an articulation of the opposition to an inauthentic performance of mitzvahs. Okay? Even though saying Shema on your deathbed is a great thing, but if you're going to do it for the wrong reasons, if you're going to do it because the Yetzer Hara is trying to strip you of who you really are, leave me out of it. I'm not interested. Okay? It's a very authentic, self-aware approach to Judaism. Right? They were opposed to any authentic performance of mitzvahs. Self-honesty was a prerequisite to a meaningful service of God. You couldn't enter into a relationship with God if you weren't honest with yourself. God simply wouldn't be interested in it. So if you look in source number two, this is a mind-boggling source. I'll be honest, I had to read it four or five times because I couldn't wrap my head around it. Maybe I'm just stupid. But assuming I'm not stupid, I had to read it, depending on who you ask. I struggled with it because it's so backwards, but it makes sense. So if you're confused, read it four more times. Okay? I'll make it easy for you. Rav Shimon ben Gamliel said, no, and again, these are all direct quotes from works referencing Pshischa. Okay? Rav Shimon ben Gamliel said, no one honored their parents more than I, and yet I found that Esav did. So I honored my father, but Esav, who we associate to not be a very nice person, he honored his father even more. Why? Because when I served my father, I would wear dirty clothes. And when I went outside, I would get rid of the dirty clothes and dress in fine clothes. But Esav didn't behave like this. He would serve his fathers at all times in his best clothes. Okay, so Esav honored his father more, because he would serve his father in nice clothes, I wore dirty clothes. The Yehudi asks, why couldn't Rav Shimon ben Gamliel wear fine clothes while serving his father as Esav did? Right, the obvious question. If what Esav did was so virtuous, why don't you copy him? He answers, clothes are also a means of projecting an image. Esav serving his father in his best clothes is a way of saying that he projected a positive image of himself to his father. Right, when Esav comes and pretends to be such a righteous person, so he's projecting a righteous image to his father. The rabbis say that he would ask his father how one tithes hay and salt. Right? Esav tried to be a good person to his father. And though he deceived his father with his supposed piety, ultimately Isaac would not have wanted to have been deceived. To the contrary, he would have preferred to have seen his son's faults in order to correct them. Hey, Yitzchak would have rather know that Esav was a bad person so he could have corrected it. Nevertheless, for a moment, Isaac enjoyed tranquility, imagining that his son was behaving correctly. So Esav tricked Yitzchak. In the process of tricking Yitzchak, he did something wrong because Yitzchak would have rather know that he was bad so he could have fixed it. But by tricking Yitzchak, what did he give his father? What did he give his father? A moment of joy. Okay? It is regarding this approach of Esav that Rav Shimon ben Gamliel said, I am unable to honor my father like Esav. He was not, namely Rav Shimon Gamliel, was not prepared to hide his faults from his father. On the contrary, he wears his dirty clothes. That is to say, he will reveal his reality to his father, his character faults, warts and all. And though his father would ultimately approve of such an approach because it allows him to correct the character failings of his son and to show him the godly path, nevertheless, for the moment, his father was upset. Therefore, says the Yehudi, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel could not honor his father as Esav did. It's a wild, wild understanding. Okay? Essentially, what it shows for us is that it shows us the attitude toward behavior in this world, right? That true relationships require what? Require honesty and truthfulness. Again, that sense of authenticity. Again, that word we keep on coming back to. And that Esav, what is Esav? Esav doesn't just represent Esav. What does Esav represent in this passage? Esav represents anyone who's willing to play to the crowd at the expense of your own integrity. Okay? Esav did a very virtuous act. He wanted his father to experience a moment of joy. He wanted his father to think that he was good. Says Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, even though that's a mitzvah, I would never do it. You want to know why? Because it's cheating who I am. And losing my sense of authenticity is the worst sin a person can do in the pshischa mindset. And so even though it means me not honoring my father on the level that Esav did, I don't care. It doesn't matter. I'm not willing to do it. Okay? Again, it's that notion of anyone who's willing, and by the way, who they really talk? It's talking about the tzaddik. In other words, anyone who's willing to play to the crowd at the expense of your own integrity, who's trying to be someone that they're not, that is the worst possible thing that a Jew can do in a pshischa mindset. Okay, so again, I share these two sources as an example, two textual examples of this notion of the sense of authenticity, purity of motive, self-honesty, etc. Okay? Person must be willing to discover who he truly is, to put everything under scrutiny, to catch a glimpse of the ego or ulterior motive. Again, think about the example of Rav Shmaya. Is there something else driving me to do what I'm doing? Is it the Yetzer Hara telling me to be holy so that all of you will think that I'm holy? Okay? Okay. And last, the person has to be true to himself in his service of God. Okay, if you look at source number 3, this is a very famous story. My kids have a book about it. You'll be familiar to it. It'll all be familiar to you. But I want to reread it through the mindset of Pshischa, where it originated, because it'll give you new understanding into this entire story. Hey, it's a famous story of a... we'll read it outside, okay? A guy has a dream. You're all capable of reading. You can read inside your own. Guy has a dream. Rav Yitzchak. Yitzchak has a dream that if he travels to Prague and near the courtyard of the king, underneath the bridge, dig in the ground and he'll find a treasure. So Rav Yitzchak goes to Prague. He goes to the king's palace. I haven't even read inside, but this is the way at least my kid's children's story says it, right? He goes to the palace and there are guards guarding it. So he comes back day after day waiting for an opportunity. Finally, he goes to one of the guards, sees him and says, why is it that you keep on coming back every day? So the Rav Yitzchak says, oh, because I had a dream, and my dream said that there is a treasure underneath the bridge. So the guard says back to him, oh, that's the silliest thing I've ever heard. That's almost as absurd as the dream I had the other night, that there's this guy from the town of Krakow named Rav Yitzchak who has a treasure buried underneath his stove. So Rav Yitzchak realizes, so he runs home, he digs underneath his stove, and sure enough, there's the treasure. Okay? Again, it's a children's book, which actually originated through the sayings of Rav Simcha Bun. Now again, it's a story we always knew. And what does the story communicate to us? That you don't have to look far, right? That sometimes the greatest blessings can be found at home. Everyone wants what everyone else has, Sometimes your greatest blessing is found right underneath your nose. Okay? Now think of it in terms of what we know about Pshischa. To give a deeper, richer understanding of the story. Okay? Number one, it communicates the sense that you won't find yourself by imitating others. Okay? Going to someone else won't allow you to find yourself. Okay? Don't imitate someone else. It means authenticity means revealing the treasure inside of yourself, not necessarily revealing someone else's treasure. It means we tend to bribe God with religious behavior, but one needs to be authentic. In other words, the treasure is found in who you really are. We try to bribe God with our religious activities. Okay, God, if I do this, maybe you can give me that. Right? What Pshischa says God wants more than anything else is you to be true to yourself, warts and all. Don't try to fake it until you make it. Okay? In an Avodas Hashem, a person has no choice but to be true to himself. Okay? That's that sense of a person has to be true to himself in the service of God, and that is what God wants more than anything else. More than any virtuous activities, you're not faking anybody. Okay? We sometimes, according to Pshischa, and he's right, it's actually very intuitive, psychologically, we sometimes try to make ourselves feel better by, whether you call it bribing God or bribing ourselves, saying, I'm not such a bad guy because I do this, that, and the other thing. Okay? Pshischa would say, no, be honest with yourself. You do some things good, but you also don't do some things good. And it takes that self-awareness. The treasure is inside of you. How do you find the treasure, though? You have to dig. Okay, digging can be long, it could be arduous, it could be difficult, but ultimately that's where you find the treasure. So in the analogy of Pshischa means a real rigorous self-awareness that can sometimes lead down a dangerous path, which is why Pshischa also, we're not going to get into this as much, focus so heavily on joy. Because if there's so much basically beating up on yourself, so you have to counter that with a profound sense of joy and simcha, otherwise it leads to depression. Okay? But again, it's a very profound sense of self-awareness. I'm going to hold, I'll be happy to answer at the end, but I want to make sure I get to everything that I want to get to. Okay? Next, the tzaddik. So we started talking about the tzaddik through classic Hasidic thought a lot. I want to now view the tzaddik through the prism of Pshischa. Again, the tzaddik through the Hasidic thought is you lose yourself in the tzaddik. The tzaddik is a vicarious, you experience Judaism in a vicarious fashion. Pshischa cannot disagree more. And you will be relieved by the Pshischa definition of the tzaddik. Because in Pshischa, the tzaddik is to be emulated. But you have to make it your own. Okay, so assuming Rabbi Goldberg is our tzaddik, it doesn't mean I lose myself in Rabbi Goldberg, that I submit my ego to him, but it means I use Rabbi Goldberg as a living paradigm of what righteousness means, and I have to then take that and make it my own. So I say, Philip Moskowitz has the following strengths, weaknesses, warts, positive, whatever. Okay, I look to Rabbi Goldberg and I try to incorporate that, but not. I don't try to become him, but I use his example to become a better me. Okay, it's focused on yourself. It's the exact, literally exact opposite of how a classic Hasidic approach to the tzaddik would be. Okay, the exact opposite. Which is why, if you were a Hasidic Rebbe at the wedding with the Aptarav, you wanted to get rid of Rav Simcha Bunim, you wanted to get rid of Pshischa, because it was a direct threat to the power of the tzaddik. Okay? It's an ant, right? If Hasidim classically stipulate a hierarchical approach, Pshischa breaks that down. So it's not about a hierarchy. Okay, anyone can achieve that level of holiness. It's not limited to a select few, like the quote that we saw earlier. The blacksmith can become a tzaddik. You could become a tzaddik. I could become a tzaddik, according to Pshischa thought. Okay? The notion that one can approach God solely on the coattails of the tzaddik, or that one can learn a page of Talmud vicariously through the learning of the tzaddik, is simply absurd. Again, it's not this vicarious approach to Judaism, but it's an autonomous. It's driven through me. I look at tzaddikim, there's a value to them, there's a benefit from them, but only in as much it helps me understand who I am supposed to be. Okay, the tzaddik draws from the wells of his own authenticity. I'm sorry, the chassid draws from the wells of his own authenticity. Even if his conclusion is different from that of the tzaddik. Okay, that's critical. Even if his conclusion is different than that of the tzaddik. If you turn to page 3 of your source sheets, source number 4. Whether or not this is true is irrelevant for us, and how we understand it is irrelevant for us also. But there's a profound point that I want to draw out of it. Okay? I am sick of hearing myself talk. Who would like to read source number 4? Hami. Sorry. No? No one wants to? No one? Go for it. Nice and loud.
Once the Yehudi was traveling with Rabbi Yudim, and in the middle of the journey, the Yehudi saw somebody at a distance. He jumped down from the carriage, went to him, and returned to his carriage. Rabbi Yudim asked him who that person was, and he replied that he was someone deceased and wanted a favor. Rabbi Yudim asked the Yehudi, "Did you do him a favor?" The Yehudi replied, "No." When Rabbi Yudim heard that, he said, "If so, you are not my Rebbe, and I am not your disciple, since you left a deceased person without doing him a favor." When the Yehudi heard Rebbe Yudim's words, he immediately jumped the second time from the carriage, went to the deceased, and did him the favor and performed for him a fixing.
Okay. So again, whether this story happened, this is beyond my... I didn't get smicha in conversations with dead people. I don't understand it, okay? But what is noteworthy from this is what? Okay? It's the Rebbe-disciple dynamic. Okay?
Learning from his disciple.
Well, not only is he learning from the disciple, but the disciple actively... Thank you, by the way, for reading. Right? Beautiful. Okay, let's give him a round of applause, right? Okay? Okay? But it's the disciple is actively challenging the authority of the Rebbe. That is almost unheard of, to challenge the authority of the tzaddik, who's the representation, the intermediary with God. Unheard of. Okay, and yet here you have a story of Rabbanim that the Rebbe disciple relationship does not imply relinquishing your own ethical judgment. If you think something is right, so you confront the Rebbe about it. Okay, and that is not the dominant view of Hasidic thought in general. Okay, so again, it's a much more autonomous approach to Judaism. It's not a subservient sense to the tzaddik, but you could actually question the tzaddik. Okay, you don't lose your own personal ethical judgment just because you're in the presence of the tzaddik. Okay, let's read source number 5. Okay, source number 5 tells us again, it's another great example of the educational philosophy of Pshischa. After the death of Rav Uri of Strelitz, whatever, one of his disciples came to Rabbanim in order to join him. Rabbanim asked, "What was his, namely Rav Uri's, main approach in his holy work to teach you in the service of God in the path of Hasidism?" In other words, teach me, what was he like as a Rebbe? "His main approach," answered the Chassid, "was to implant in our hearts a sense of humility and lowliness. And his holy custom was that whoever came to him, whether he was an important rabbi or a wealthy person, he first had to take 2 big buckets and to fill them with water from the well in the marketplace or to do some demeaning work in public." Okay, so the first thing Rav Uri had people do was demean themselves to make them feel lowly and humble. Rabbanim replied, "Let me tell you a story. It once happened that the king decreed that 3 people, 2 wise men and an idiot, were be placed in a dark dungeon. Every day, food and utensils were lowered down to them. The thick darkness confused the mind of the idiot so that he couldn't understand what they were giving him. For example, he thought that the spoon was a plate and so on, and thus he didn't know to hold the cup to his mouth and to eat and drink. Thus, each time, one of the wise men taught him with signs how to know what the utensils were, but it was necessary to teach him each time, because each time they were given different utensils. The second wise man sat silently and didn't teach him anything. On one occasion, the first wise man asked the second wise man, "Why do you sit silently and not teach the idiot anything, so that I have to toil each time to learn with him? Why don't you teach him just for once?" The second wise man replied, "You are continually making an effort to learn with him, but there is no limit. For what will you do if tomorrow they give him another utensil? yet again you will have to teach him. And what will be if he knows how to use this and does not know how to use that? I, parentheses on the other hand, am thinking and figuring out how to make a hole in the roof to let in light so that he will be able to see everything. Okay? What is the difference between the two wise men? The first wise men, according, again, this is a direct knock on the classic Rebbe, the classic Tzaddik, the classic Hasidic approach. Okay? The first wise man simply wants to teach people how to eat. Okay? And he's willing to do it every, but he's not teaching them to be self-sufficient. Okay? He's only teaching them how to be righteous if they're in the presence of the Rebbe. The second wise man is the Pshischa approach, which says don't just teach them how to use the utensils, let's figure out a mechanism that they themselves can see, to give them their own wings to fly, to give them light that they can do things on their own. It happens to be a beautiful approach to education in general, between a teacher who simply teaches a student to memorize facts, but to always be reliant on the teacher, and the teacher who gives the student the tools to go out and experience education on his or her own. Okay, that pshischa, it's a direct knock on the classic Hasidic approach, because it's saying you, the Rebbe, if the Talmud is always dependent on the Rebbe, then you're just going to, it's like a vicious cycle. Whereas I am showing you the light, I'm trying to figure out a way to create light so that you can experience God on your own. Okay? I think that's a beautiful example of what we are trying to talk about. Okay? And just two more sources I want to share with you tonight. Page 4. Again, I want to show you the autonomous nature of Pshischa thought, where each person is individual. No one is there to simply replicate someone else, to mimic someone else, but you're supposed to be your own self. Okay? Source number 6. Can I have another volunteer? Oh, come on. We went. Yeah, go. Nice and loud.
And that is what is meant by the statement, a man is obligated to say, when will my actions change the actions of my father? From the time of the Yerba Baba. That is to say that there should be a connection to his father's action, but not that he should end the righteous past and the nature of the world. And he said the following, if you were to ask me, how much would you pay to change your quality to that of Abraham, my father, so that he could be like you and you would be like him, I wouldn't give it.
Right? Again, what does God gain? Right? We're supposed to say, the Medrash says, every day we're supposed to say, when are my actions going to be like the actions of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? Says Pshischa, that doesn't mean that we're actually supposed to be like Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. That's absurd. I don't want to be anyone else. I want to be me. That's all that God wants me to be. So what then does the role of the Tzaddik, of the Rebbe play? It's a living paradigm, or in this case, a dead paradigm. But it's a paradigm of something that I'm supposed to look to. I'm supposed to incorporate that, but ultimately I make it my own. It becomes part of who I am. Okay, and another example, the last source, number 7. Rebbe said, what is the straight path that a person should choose? Whatever is honorable to the doer. Right? It's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. That is to say that the soul of each individual has its own style in the service of God and the performance of Torah and commandments, which he should not change. Therefore, he should not take a path that is not special or unique to him. Even though he greatly admires the way of a service of a certain righteous person, and that way appeals to him more than his own. Right? You might look at the Rebbe and say, oh, I want to be like the Rebbe. He's doing it much better than I am. Nevertheless, he should not move. A righteous person must hold fast to his own path. And that is the proof that it is his path, that his path is true. And this is the sense of the above Mishnah, that he has a path for himself that is correct for him and by which he holds. Nevertheless, he can praise and admire the path of the fellow tzaddik. Now understand this matter, for it is a major principle in the service of God not to be arrogant, not to pretend to do what is not one's true level, even in worldly matters. Okay? So it's this authenticity in a relationship with God. It's an authenticity in your relationship with yourself, not tricking yourself, not fooling yourself, not trying to be like anybody else, not trying to be the tzaddik, but using the tzaddik as a paradigm to become a better you. Okay? So we saw, first of all, an introduction to classic Hasidic approach, specifically in relationship to the tzaddik. We learned a little bit about Rav Simcha Bunim, and then when it came to the philosophy, we identified 3 distinct ways where it differed fundamentally. Okay, in a very threatening way from classic Hasidic thought. Number one is the emphasis of Torah learning, accusing classic Hasidism of basically having become dumbed down, of having lost its true allegiance to Torah Judaism. Number two, it basically accused the average Hasid and the Rebbe of a lack of purity of motive, of an inauthenticity, of seeking the adulation of the masses to the exclusion of your own personal integrity. And therefore, Pshischa focused more than anything else a sense of authenticity, a sense of purity of motive. And last is the relationship to the tzaddik, where it's not that one loses himself to the tzaddik, it's not that one needs to vicariously experience Judaism through the tzaddik, but rather there's an autonomous nature to my Judaism. That through the tzaddik I experience a paradigm of what righteousness should look like, but the single most important thing is to take that and to make it my own. Okay? To once I understand who I am and what my path might be, to incorporate other paradigms into myself, but to never lose myself. Because again, it's that authenticity. And that's why the book that I recommend that's about Rav Simcha Bunim is called The Quest for Authenticity. Because that's really what Pshischa represented. It represented a quest for authenticity. That's what put it at such direct odds with classic Hasidic thought. And that's why the Hasidim of the time wanted to excommunicate Rabbunim. Rabbunim's approach was challenging directly their tzaddik, or the tzaddik Talmud paradigm that had been established. Once you challenge that, you challenge Hasidism at its core. And that, when we come back to our original story, is why they wanted to excommunicate Rabbunim in particular, but Pshischa mindset in general. There are things I didn't get to tonight that I didn't mention, that I'll just mention quickly. Okay? When we talk about, when we think of a Chassid and their lack of awareness of the times of Tefillah, times of davening, that originates with Rav Simcha Bunim. That was one of the major attacks on Rav Simcha Bunim. But you have to understand why Rav Simcha Bunim said not to daven when the times of davening were. Because what would davening mean if I didn't have a proper self-awareness at the time of davening? That's called fraudulent. That's called fake. Okay? So if I were to come to davening at 9 o'clock in the morning because that's when BRS had its minion, but I didn't spend the time in advance properly figuring out, right, properly doing a self-awareness and introspection, then I'm a fake. Then my davening means nothing. Again, when authenticity is the single most important thing, so therefore it's a logical next step to say, daven whenever you're ready. It's better to daven from a moment of strength than a moment of weakness, so to speak. Just because everyone else is davening at 8 o'clock in the morning doesn't mean that that's when you need to daven. You need to daven when you're ready. You need to daven when you put in the time beforehand to enter into a meaningful and authentic relationship with God. So again, the knocks on Pshischa have to be understood within the context of their philosophy. But everything comes back to this quest for authenticity. And so I hope now you have the other side of the coin to what Rabbi Kasorla promoted last week in terms of the classic Hasidic approach. This is what I'll call the divergent approach. Again, after the Kutzker Rebbe, they kind of became a hybrid. They became merged into one, into our general understanding of Pshischa thought in general. Okay? Before I end, next week is the final week. You're learning Rav Nachum of Breslin. It is, again, I have no doubt Rabbi Goldberg will present it in an amazing way. He is a fascinating personality. It's a fascinating personality. So if you haven't been coming, come. Tell your friends to come, because I think there's so many misnomers about who Rav Nachman was. And I think it'll be a very fascinating class. And of course, it's the CM, it's the culmination of our entire program. Yeah.